Well, hello once again. Good afternoon and welcome, Felcha, to all. This is Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM. My name is Scotty Hertz, coming to you live once again from a secret abandoned location somewhere in this town. And joining me from his not-so-secret lair in town is Chief Assignment Editor and Guelph Politico, Adam A. Donaldson. Adam, how are you today?
Oh, I'm same old, same old.
Same old, same old, eh?
Thank you for having me remotely in the secret abandoned bunker.
Well, it's the least I can do. I mean, you know, that is my job. If I cannot make that happen, then I might as well just hang up the headphones right now. So,
There's a show.
And there's a show to do. That's right. Correct. The at 5:30 we will have Adam had an interview a little bit earlier this week with Bill Karsten, who is a Halifax City Councillor and president of the Federation of Canadian Municipalities. But first, we have a couple of topics to cover from the 5:30 window. The House of Commons is sort of sitting once again in a hybrid system, and we'll talk a bit about that and the ramifications of that and how that's been going. But off the top, we once again turn to possibly the top story, if not in Ontario, then in the nation and in other places around the world, is the crisis in long-term care as it relates to the COVID-19 pandemic in the world, but specific to Ontario. The Canadian Armed Forces were called in both in Ontario and Quebec to deal with, or at least try to help to deal with the locations that were worst case scenario, let's say, five in Ontario and I think a few more in Quebec. And they have written a report absolutely trashing the system, let's say, a system which is trash, and a lot of people have been bringing this up for years and years and years. But now, all of a sudden, everybody's going to listen because the military went in. And I'm not sure, Adam, did they not expect the Canadian Armed Forces to make a point of the where everything had gone wrong? I wasn't expecting, like, they didn't say, okay, we're going to go in and do this mission, and then we're going to write a report about it. But I didn't realize that this report was going to come out, but I guess they felt that they had to do it from what they had seen once they were deployed.
Yeah, and it should be noted it's not because Canadian forces weren't at all. I think there's 626 long-term care homes in Ontario that they were not deployed to all of them, and the report had specific revelations about what was going on in five, but you can certainly extrapolate that, you know, these five where there are very, like, worst case scenario, and these were five of the places where that were kind of hit the hardest by COVID. And I did the math. In these five places, there have been 221 deaths from COVID-19, just in these five places. Now, that five isn't, like, spread out equally. I think the highest was at Orchard Villa, where there was 77, and the lowest was 11 at the one in Brampton, Grace Manor. But yeah, it does seem a bit odd that, you know, given my extensive experience working in retail, if you had somebody from higher up in the organization, you spent coming to do an inspection, you spent the day before cleaning the store from stem to stern and making it look like it just came off, like, the factory floor. It does seem a little bizarre that no one at these places, and maybe that's another symptom of just how overwhelmed they are, that no one thought to, hey, here's an idea. Let's pretend that we know how to use PPE right, or let's get some of the bugs out of here, or let's clean up our patients who were, you know, in many cases in these five homes, literally lying in their own filth. It's shocking that no one seemed to give a damn.
Well, and that's the thing. No one has, I wouldn't say no one, but there has been very little of a damn given for a very long time. Once this news came out, there's people did a bit of digging, gone back in time. I saw two things in particular that were making the rounds. One was Howard Hampton's last election, which I believe was 2007, and he was yelling at the media because the media was very interested in talking about the religious schools funding issue, which was big at that time. I think we were talking about it on Beyond the Ballot Box for sure. I do recall that. And he was very agitated, and they made a big deal about this because he kept saying there's people in soiled diapers. Mm-hmm. People sitting in soiled diapers. Your elders are sitting in, and this is, that was 13 years ago. Prior to that, the Toronto Star, and that's, I guess that's another story for another day, the sale of the Toronto Star, but when they were doing deeper editorial and expose work, did an analysis of a case back in 2003 where a senior had fallen in a chair due to lack of attention and had choked to death. And when presented with this information, the, I believe it was the Minister of Health at the time, George Smitherman, a Liberal, was crying. And famously, his picture went on the front of the paper of George Smitherman cries. Mm. And Doug Ford cries. And they all cry. But I wouldn't say nothing has been done, but I'm going to slide right in an opinion here, but I'm sure quite a few people will agree with me, and Adam probably knew that this was coming. We forget, and you and I talked, I'm positive we talked about this last year in the fall, but the cuts that came to long-term care back then from this government, and one of the things that was cut was, guess what? Inspections.
Mm-hmm.
Inspections went from being, we're going to have a regular series of inspections to, well, it's, it wasn't even voluntary. It became a complaint-driven exercise. I'm fairly sure that that happened because of lobbying from various groups, populated with a lot of conservatives and liberals, or ex, or affiliated, I should add. And we don't have enough time to cover all of that, but that is a completely separate realm as to what is going on. When everybody is saying, oh, we had no idea, we had no idea, we had no idea, everybody knows. If you have a senior, if you have an elder in your life or in any way connected to that system, you know. Doug Ford knew. The prior government knew as well. They all knew and they all did nothing. And trust the Beaverton to sum it all up. I'm not sure if you saw that thing making the rounds that they said all previous premiers of Ontario have blamed the previous premier. All the way back to the ghost of John Robarts. And he's like, people are living past 55 years old now. I don't believe this. So there's a long tradition of, well, because Ford did it too. He's like, well, we inherited this problem. You didn't help when you made the cuts last fall. Fact.
And he also pivoted to blaming inspectors for not wanting to go into long-term care.
Oh, yeah. Those taking the bullets for the unions, right? Or the union people, right? Who have been cut to the bone. We're having a heck of a time making a go of it in regular times, let alone a crisis like this, and not wanting to go in because in all likelihood, and I think there's going to be an announcement made, something to this effect, okay, no PPE, no organization, just total chaos. So what were they supposed to do?
And these things have been, you know, been erupting all along. You know, you go back far enough, you can find in 2009, there was a Center for Policy Alternatives report about issues in long-term care, even to earlier this year before the pandemic broke out. I think we talked about this the last time long-term care came up, but there was the CBC investigative report that pointed out that there were nine regular inspections that were done in 2019, but over 2,800 sort of complaint-driven inspections. Again, you know, when you factor in there are 626 long-term care homes in Ontario, divide that into 2,800. That's about five inspections for every home. Now, of course, that's not precisely how it works out. That's just the naked math of it. Having said that, you know, they were so busy putting Band-Aids on the problem that they kind of kept missing the problem. And that was the kind of the whole point of the so-called RQI inspections, the resident quality inspections, was to, you know, hopefully keep standards up so that you would have fewer complaints. And it seemed to have gone the other way entirely. Meanwhile, clearly people in these residents were suffering. And clearly a lot of these residents, because three of the five are privately owned, it's worth pointing out. Clearly there was some maybe bottom lining going on by cutting corners with PPE or by cutting corners with training or by cutting corners with scheduling, because there was the one home, I can't remember which one, I think it was Eatonville, but there was one of them mm-hmm. where there was no PSW on duty after 2:30 PM. So half the day, pretty much, there's nobody whose job it is to sort of keep up with the care of the seniors or, you know, the residents living there. And this also comes down to, you know, smack the government around some more. And I mentioned this because I was watching TV yesterday when Evan Solomon got on his high horse and said, you know what, this government, they campaigned on not increasing minimum wage. And what do most people in long-term care make? Minimum wage. It's like, yeah, dude, the media was part of that too by saying, you know, what does, you know, what do people making minimum wage need to make more money for? It's not like it's a career. It's not like they need a lot of skill to do their jobs. It's not like this. It's not like that, where, you know, they won't pull up themselves by their bootstraps and get better jobs if they're paid a better minimum wage. And it's like, well, now we see the end result of that, is that there were a lot of people in long-term care, overworked, incredibly underpaid, and this is what happens. And, you know, so maybe now can we have start having serious conversations about appropriate compensation for people, appropriate training for people, so that, you know, we do not get into situations like this again.
Absolutely. And I can honestly say the PSWs that I got to know over my the period where I was deeply involved in long-term care earned every cent. But when I hear some of the things coming out in this report, it's not news to me. And that's my experience to go back about 4, 5, 6 years. It's been a while. It's not a recent thing for me, but the concerns expressed, and there's a long list, wasn't any different back then. It probably wasn't any different 20 years ago when George Smitherman was crying when somebody died from a seatbelt to the neck. But Marilee Fullerton,
mm-hmm.
Marilee two-tier Fullerton, I think has a lot of nerve. Now, the NDP is calling for her resignation. I don't know if that is going to do anything. She is a doctor, which is significant considering, you know, the usual, let's say, sometimes empty shirts get given portfolios that don't really belong there. But that's another story. Again, is a doctor. But some of her tweets have surfaced from last fall, talking about taking some heat back then about the cuts to long-term care, among other things. And it was, well, we need to relieve them of regulatory burdens, and there's lots of administrative barriers. And my personal favorite, cut red tape. We need to cut red tape. So how do they do that? Cutting hours for PSWs who are already underpaid. Remember that business? We talked about it. One shower a week for people. Certain types of therapy, the chaplains were cut, other therapists, activation therapists, which is keep people moving, cut, hours of dietitians, reduced staff. This was all in the wake of the Wettlaufer report, and I think that was what we were probably talking about. And then was tabled, still to be reviewed, sitting on it right now. They said, well, we're gonna look at that. It's going to probably take us about a year. That hasn't happened. And again, that's another realm of something that goes on or has been going on. It was sort of hinted at in the military's report about possible sexual assaults. Like it's horrific. And they are in locations that are particularly horrific. But that's not to say that there aren't a series of maybe more minor yet somewhat major problems in other locations as well, that places that weren't mentioned. So I really don't know what this is going to take. There's some people saying we should nationalize it, should be brought into public hands, brought into OHIP or whatever the healthcare is in a particular province. But I'm not even sure if that's going to do it. Really,
I don't know if taking it out of provincial hands and bringing it up to the national level solves any problems. You know, adding it, you know, taking it to a higher level of bureaucracy. And then, of course, I guess the reverse of that is talking about downloading. And it's like, well, can are we really going to dump more on municipalities? Unfortunately, this is a provincial problem. It is going to stay a provincial problem. Again, I don't know what firing Dr. Fullerton will solve. It probably wouldn't solve anything. The bigger problem is that, and I think we talked about this last week, a couple of weeks ago, the revelation that long-term care homes, the private homes, were hiring former conservative staffers to act as lobbyists. I think they, given what was revealed by Canadian Forces, that sudden hiring blitz of new lobbyists with government experience and ties may explain why, the report may explain why that was going on. It's something that is not going to be solved without people digging in and recognizing the systemic things that caused this to begin with. And that may go as far back as, Aaron Worry on CBC wrote about this, And I think the headline was something to the effect of, you know, not having long-term care as part of the Canada Health Act is like the original sin of that. But I would expand that out further, because I think there are a lot of things now that weren't part of the Canada Health Act that if people go back in time would say this should be definitely part of the act in terms of like, yeah, long-term care is one of them. But I also, I'll also add dental care. I would also add like mental health. There are a lot of things going back now where, you know, so much of your health care, you are basically on your own having to finance it. Unless you, you know, kind of, you know, basic care or emergency care. But the vast majority of your ongoing health concerns, when you get old, whether that's your teeth, whether that's your mental health, whether that's pharma care, that's another piece of this, you are on your own, unless you have private insurance of some description.
Well, and that's the thing, the Canada Health Act goes back to the 60s, right? And that's the joke. And it shouldn't really be a joke, but it is like, you know, the ghost of John Robarts. I mean, Canada Health Act was passed in 65, but also pensions were the Canada Pension Plan you retired at 65, and people generally died around 67 back then. So yeah. That's, you know, now there's the casualties that we've been hearing about are people 80s, 90s, older, right? So not everybody, but the majority. And obviously, a topic for another day, because
I will add that I posted the report on the Politico page that I did a recap of everything the report said, but it's like 15 pages long, so it's really a quick read. But I think it is such necessary reading for people to sort of understand just how bad things were in those five homes.
Definitely. I've yet to get to it, but I think I might need a bit of a bracer before I do read it. So, speaking of federal help and federal situation, Parliament has reopened in Ottawa. Well, not reopened. It's sort of rebooted. I keep seeing this. They keep calling it the hybrid system in other media, in that they're going to meet. There was a bit of back and forth about how they were going to meet. And I think pressure was coming from the Conservatives. They're like, we should just have a full parliament. And they were no, but they got backing from the NDP directly, saying that we will stick with this hybrid system. We'll put up some beautiful big screen TVs in the chamber, the actually temporary chamber, right? They're only in there because it's being renovated, and run it that way so we can keep the distances. Now, conversely, I happened to see a shot of the Ontario, the action at Queen's Park, and it looked like everybody was there, but they were wearing masks. Like, there was no distancing going on, and there was no Doug Ford either, but that is another story. The Ottawa is going to stick with this plan, I think, for now, or for the indefinite period, or did you hear otherwise? So is there a cap on it as to how long they're going to meet virtually?
The hybrid model? No,
it's more like a committee too, though. It's not regular parliament, is it? Like it's
yeah.
They're not calling it a committee. It's like a,
for branding purposes, it's like the Committee on COVID-19 or something. It's not technically the House of Commons and Parliament meeting. They're going to continue meeting through like the last week of June. It's going to be four meetings a week. I think it's two and two. It's 40 some odd members in the House, and then everybody else is on the big screens. Four times a week through to the end of June, and then they'll take the typical July and August off and come back in September, where maybe hopefully everyone gets to be there again. But I mean, that's not 100% certain either. And I think it's probably the way to go. I mean, because I understand that it's, you know, 300 and some odd people in the room, and they can't vote because they haven't been able to work that out logistically. I mean, you look at Guelph City Council, they're voting on stuff, but even though they're all, like, almost every member of council is appearing virtually, but that's a show of hands, which gets a little tricky when you start getting in triple digits. But having said that, you're not just talking about the 330 some odd people in the House, right? You're talking about their staffs. You're talking about the support staff, the people who work in the House, who aren't, you know, assigned to a politician. You're talking about the custodians and the maintenance staff too. Mm-hmm. Visitors. You're talking about putting so many people in danger, and that's just inside the building. That's before you get to hotels where, you know, people where, you know, parliamentarians stay during the week. That's before you get to the airports and people on airplanes and people at the originating airports and all that stuff. It just, it makes so much sense to not put the cart before the horse. I almost said the monkey before the cart, but that doesn't make any sense.
But I think these days it might actually make sense. I'm going to steal that one. Don't put the monkey before the cart.
But I mean, it makes so much more sense, which just makes, you know, Andrew Scheer shaking his fist at it all just all the more problematic.
I'd heard a comment from a House Leader, a Conservative House Leader, Candace Bergen, and she was doing this, well, we believe in Parliament, as if to imply that no one else there believes in Parliament. And she's a holdover MP from the Pirogue King, Stephen Harper, so she's one to talk. And the same was with Andrew Scheer trying to score points. The problem with this whole thing is that, I mean, I do get it that they want Parliament to sit and they want the machinery to work. But if it's to try and score points, they can't really do that because there is so much other stuff going on. You know, this other than, say, us talking about it or just getting a general mention in the media, there is a whole ton of other things on the radar that no one, I mean, people do care that the House of Commons does sit, but it's not on it. I don't even think it's in the top five in terms of what people have their eyes on right now.
Well, I heard Vashika Pell or somebody on CBC calling it inside baseball, and that's, you know, probably the best way to refer it. Like, this whole thing that ate up 2 days of debate in the House, and, you know, in terms of how we're going to meet, what we're going to meet. I think that people don't honestly think that, even in the best of circumstances, think too hard about parliamentary procedure. That's maybe a shame, because everyone should know how their government works. But having said that, too, I do, as you pointed out, I do find the consternation rather rich. Charlie Angus, I think that were his exact words about the conservative reaction. But I also noticed that you had a lot of people on the right-hand side of things, like Kelly McPherson, Kelly McParlin, sorry, from the National Post, who's a columnist for the National Post. He said that Singh should be deeply ashamed of the squalid little deal he's done with the Trudeau Liberals to shut down Parliament for another 3 months. It's like, first of all, Parliament would be shut down for July and August anyway. Second of all, still in business as it is, like, now MPs can ask questions about things not related to COVID. And there were a lot of questions the other day about, you know, what happened in Nova Scotia, the snowbirds, and all that. And then finally, he's attacking Singh for basically being a good opposition leader, because in case people aren't aware, Singh said, you know what, we'll support your call to keep this hybrid parliament going. In exchange, we want you to consider sick days. We want to create some form where people can have 10 sick days available to them, especially when we get back in the fall. We're going to be dealing with cold and flu season, as well as perhaps a second wave of COVID. It makes sense to give people an option to have paid sick days. And Trudeau said, yeah, okay.
Yeah, because it's that type of horse trading that we see in a minority situation in regular times. But also, speaking of the irregular times, it would seem that at least, well, four out of the five parties are applying for the subsidy that's going on. I did see the bloc leader dropped his name completely. I apologize, bloc leader.
Yves-François Legault, isn't that his
name? That sounds right. I feel terrible. I know the guy to see the guy, saying that there, you know, there's no way we're going to take this money because there's a lot of other people out there. You know, he was pretty much doing that. Well, the workers need it. Whereas the other parties, so NDP, Conservatives, Liberals, and Greens, want to pay their people and want to dip into the fund to keep them working? Question mark. I mean, I suppose some of there are piles of them that are probably still working. Any time they're sitting or making appearances, and I guess still dealing with questions from constituents and Canadians. Some of them might be working, but there's obviously a lot of them that have been furloughed, let's say, or idled.
Well, if we're talking about people who work in constituency office, they're government people and aren't being paid by the government of Canada. But, you know, we're talking about people who do the partisan work at the campaign headquarters, and, you know, a lot of them are, you know, they're not necessarily the people, you know, scheming and practicing the quote-unquote dark arts. But, you know, they're people who are just answering phones or doing the accounting and what have you.
Dominic Cummings types, to use a UK reference, but yeah.
Right. It's just, you know, yeah, it looks bad. It smells bad. But, you know, at the end of the day, those are people, too, who, you know, should be able to you still have jobs and still have money in the account and be able to, you know, buy groceries what they need to. I mean, it's kind of inside baseball stuff. What got me was that it was like late last week, it was revealed that the NDP had dipped into the wage subsidy benefit to pay political staff. And then we find out on Monday and Tuesday, actually, it's everybody except the Bloc. And this is after, you know, the week, you know, Jagmeet Singh and the NDP were taking hits all weekend long about it. It's like, you're taking government cheddar and blah, 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 blah. And it's like, no, everybody's doing it except the Bloc. And it's just, it's been part of the thing. It's been a whole week for poor Jagmeet Singh, which is why I retweeted this picture somebody took of him riding his bike around Ottawa, wearing his suit in 36 degree weather.
That little foldy bike he's got, I don't know.
Yeah, it's just, you know, I'm sorry Andrew Scheer can't be as good a opposition leader as Jagmeet Singh. Sorry, it you know, Jagmeet Singh was transactional, which is typically a conservative attribute, but there you go.
Yeah, you know, Scheer he's just trying so hard. He's trying almost too hard. I mean, everybody knows he's yesterday's man, and nobody really cares, and I don't know if he's trying to score points for the potential leader, whoever the heck that's going to be, and that's totally off the radar as well. That's like super inside baseball. That's like,
but that was the fun part of it all too, is that you had the Bloc being against the wage subsidy, but also the conservative leadership contenders being against taking the wage subsidy too. So that was interesting.
Yes, and they'll fight that out not till the death, but till whenever that is. When is that anyway? I can't remember.
It's the end of August.
The end of August. And then the Greens is in October?
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I was going to say, that's some things to look forward to. But like I said, in terms of it being on the hot list, it's kind of like, well, yeah, we sort of know that's going on. But yeah, you have to be, I guess we need another term for inside baseball. I don't know, the power and politics types like us, yeah, who do this every week. You're like, oh, it's going on. I haven't seen the PNP in a while. It's a long story, but it just hasn't happened. But shall we leave that there?
Yeah, let's leave that there.
Excellent. Okay. So you are listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM for another Thursday, and we are going to take a short break. For some PSAs and some information, but we will be back in short order with more news and views and all of that stuff. So stay tuned.
I understand that people want to get out there. I understand that, but we have to be responsible. It just burns me up. These are the things we know. All we have to do is stay the places. Oh, from the Queen's Park.
And that was, we know who that was, Premier Doug Ford. Featuring P, it says PMJT. And that song was Bunch of Yahoos, the Bunch of Yahoos remix. Something that's there's still a lot of Yahoos out there. And if we have a bit of time, we may discuss the Yahooism that's been going on in lots of places, including Toronto. But first, Adam, would you like to set this up, this fantastic interview that you did?
Sure. It's with Bill Karsten, who is a Halifax City Councillor. Actually, he recently announced his retirement earlier this week. He's not going to run again in the Halifax election later this year. But in the meantime, he's still there on Halifax City Council. He's the president of the Federation of Canadian Municipalities. And that's why I reached out to speak to him, because they're trying to petition the federal government to give Canadian cities $10 billion in emergency funding, with about $2.5 billion just for transit alone, because of, you know, a lot of places like Guelph are running transit and are running it free, so that, you know, you don't have people touching money or tickets or transfers and all that. So it's a pretty big deal. This is also a day of promotion on the part of Transit. So I can't remember the hashtag off the top of my head, unfortunately. Maybe I'll look it up as the interview is being played. But they're trying to promote transit, promote using transit, promote higher levels of government to help support transit. Otherwise, you know, you're going to get what's happening in Waterloo Region on Monday, where they are charging to use the GRT again. And that's going to be a little tricky. And again, to keep up social distancing with people touching fare boxes and money and bus passes and transfers and all that. So
yep,
I think that adequately sets everything up. So I will leave it to you to press play when ready.
Right on. Let's get to that now.
I guess to start with, out of the interest of sort of comparing where we are in different points of the country, I'm in Guelph, you're in Halifax. What's been the effect of COVID-19 on your work as a counselor in Halifax and just the Halifax area in general? You know, can you paint that picture?
Sure, I can. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to this important issue, Adam. So municipalities, no doubt across the country from coast to coast, are all in a very, very tight financial crunch right now. And the unfortunate part is that financial crunch is inevitably going to cause some real interruptions in vital services that municipalities provide to their citizens. We're on the front lines, and some of these vital services are incredibly important, particularly at this time of COVID. So here in Halifax, it's a great case example that is actually live and in the works right now, and that is that we, before COVID, have not yet completed our final budget. We were very close, but then COVID struck. So council has been working diligently over the last week and will continue to work today, tomorrow, and into a few days next week to literally chop $58 million out of what had been the proposed budget. So that is, it's almost like a prophecy in many ways come true, that we knew weeks and weeks ago. We started sounding the alarm bells that appealed to federal government in particular to provide emergency funding, because we knew that this is just not because of all of the lost revenue, you know, from things like those cities that have transit, an incredible amount of lost revenue. Here again in Halifax, we're looking at about $2.4 million a month. In Toronto, that equates to $23.5 million every month in lost revenue on transit.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the other user fees that municipalities would normally collect. There's a whole long, long list of them. Everything from parking meters that many municipalities, including Halifax, has suspended to the fees we'd normally collect on building permits and rec centers and sports fields. None of that's coming in, and subsequently that's equated, that all together with the transit and those other equates to be between 10 to 15 billion in lost revenue that municipalities are facing.
Mm-hmm. Before I get into the broader picture from the FCM perspective, I am curious, because here in Ontario, our municipalities, the fiscal year is January to December, so the COVID crisis hit in just the end of the first quarter of our fiscal years. Does dealing with this in the midst of coming to terms with next year's budget, is that maybe the preferential way to be addressing the fiscal shortfall, that you have like a clearer idea rather than being in the middle of the fiscal year like other municipalities here in Ontario?
Yeah, I do totally understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, there's no one size fits all in this instance in terms of when FCM, Federation of Canadian Municipalities, has in excess of 2,000 members.
Mm-hmm.
And it's obvious and somewhat logical, I guess, to say that they are all in different levels of financial security when it comes to cash flow and whatnot. And the other element that we haven't mentioned is the incredible amount of lost revenue from folks that just can't pay their property tax.
Mm.
So what it's actually becoming, Adam, for some municipalities across the country, is a cash flow issue, a liquidity issue, of where, you know, if there's no revenue coming in, and even though the budget's set for this particular year, you don't have the funding coming in to actually fulfill those commitments in the budget.
Mm.
So it is an urgent situation. It's a crisis. Now, you bring up a good point in terms of next year's budget. We're not even at a point yet for most municipalities really being able to understand what kind of continued hit this will be on our budgets.
Right.
Because, you know, again, the lost revenue on property tax. You know, we wish and hope and can only pray that, for an example, every small business in Canada will get back up and running.
Mm.
But if they don't, that's going to leave a void again for municipalities in terms of what they'd normally pick up on commercial revenue tax.
Mm-hmm. So I think that brings us to FCM's proposal to get $10 billion in emergency funding from the federal government. That press release was almost a month ago.
Yeah, 3 weeks ago now, or yeah, even a little longer.
And I realize like these things, you know, government, even at a time of crisis, moves slowly. But I mean, has there been any signals you've been seeing from the federal government that, that something like an emergency funding package for cities is on the horizon?
Yeah, so again, great question. Obviously, that's one that we monitor on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. So what I can say to you is, number one, we do have a direct ear of a few of the cabinet ministers. And in fact, Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland has had conference calls with us on many occasions, and we've certainly expressed our concern to her. We are cognizant as well, Adam,
mm-hmm.
that this is as much a provincial issue. So, you know, for those that may say, well, why aren't you going to provinces? Individual members across the country are also talking to their provincial governments. We know that they have a responsibility, but along with the announcement from 3 weeks ago, really, in essence, what our plea was, because of the dire crises that we're in, is for the federal government, who has some leverage in dealing with provinces,
mm.
for them to show us the kind of leadership that this takes. So to get directly to your question, where are we now? We are so very pleased that several things have happened in the last week.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, on Sunday of this past week, the Toronto Star editorial board published a piece calling on the other orders of government to help municipalities with our lost revenue, and noted if they don't, the economic recovery is at stake. You can't have an economic recovery on the other end of COVID with municipalities across the country, small, medium, and large, actually hurting financially.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to deal with that for the sake of the rebound and roaring back from what we've all gone through. A couple other big developments is in your province, which mm. we're incredibly pleased with, is that Premier Doug Ford commented at his daily press conference now a week ago, I think maybe even a week yesterday, that his government will come to the table to respond to the financial crisis
mm-hmm.
if the federal government will be there too. So we give him full accolades for making the statement and for providing leadership and action. And the action that he took is he brought it up at the weekly First Minister's meeting last Thursday night. That's the Prime Minister and I don't know how many cabinet ministers, but certainly then all of the premiers. And we know it was raised there. And then to fast forward, the other really important movement on this incredibly important issue is that on Saturday, In his regular briefing, the Prime Minister was asked at his press conference, about the status that municipalities were in. Number one, he acknowledged that there's an issue. Mm-hmm. He understood that. That's mm-hmm. great. Okay, because understanding is the first step to action, right?
Right.
So he not only understood, but said that the provinces agree that there needs to be direct support for municipalities, and the federal government will be there. He's on record saying that the federal government will be there to partner with the provinces. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing some real momentum, and we keep up constantly, and that's why I'm so pleased with anyone across the country, including today with yourself, Adam, for highlighting this important issue, because we keep saying that even those are good news comments that have been done, we continue to drive home our urgent message that there's no economic recovery without directly supporting municipalities in our crises.
Right. I remember during the federal election, and I mean, that seems like a million years ago now.
Doesn't it?
That, you know, there was a lot of discussion about, you know, where municipalities stand in the partnership of Confederation, and how it was cities and towns were equal partners with the federal government, the province. Crises like this really kind of test those relationships. So have you, as both the president of FCM and as a councillor in your own city, have you felt equal partner with the other levels of government in dealing with the crisis?
Yeah, so again, you know, I'm always a total optimist in terms of, that I am a total optimist, and on that direct question, I'll directly say that I truly do believe that we'll resolve this issue. I'm just very confident that when there's a need, you know, it's like if you want to call it partners or a family, when there's a need among partners or among family, mm-hmm. Another family member or another partner steps up. And I truly do believe that will happen. Now, to a broader point of your question, mm-hmm. the fact remains that what COVID has really laid open and bare, okay, mm-hmm. is that because of the financial crunch we're in, and the fact that we can't run deficits by legislation mm-hmm. in each province, it has laid to bear that the fiscal framework that municipalities, that local order of governments work under, is totally and completely flawed and not manageable and sustainable in a modern era. We keep getting more responsibilities. We have 60% of the infrastructure in Canada. Mm. 80% of the population lives in our cities and towns and so on, and yet we only totally collect about 8-9 cents of every tax dollar. Mm. So we need, and we've been saying that for a decade now, that our fiscal framework is broken and not sustainable. So subsequently, if we're going to really move this country even further ahead, and we give this current government as well full marks for some of the things they've partnered with municipalities on, and we're indebted to what's happened in the past, but today is the day today. And just to close my thought, we will be certainly willing and able as municipal leaders across the country, and we certainly have our big city mayors, which have a caucus or a group within FCM, certainly saying the same message, that we stand prepared to have a good modern discussion on our fiscal framework. Now is not the time to have that quibble.
Right. No. At the same time, though, I think that there's probably going to be a lot of things that have to be done in order to establish like the COVID reaction and sort of segue that into a more permanent state of being. I'm thinking about things like having permanent barriers on buses to protect drivers. And you know, even at like the, you know, at Guelph City Hall, is called Service Guelph, where you go in and do the business of, you know, whatever you're doing business with, whether that's getting a bus pass or getting, you know, your building permits or what have you. There would have to be plexiglass and stuff there. I guess I'm wondering, you're going to have to operate on multiple levels, right? Because you're talking about the emergency need, but there's going to have to be some sort of permanent changes in terms of reacting to an ongoing operating crisis. Yeah, operating things. Yeah. And then you're also talking about eventually having the bigger conversation about how cities are funded.
Exactly. And that is part of the fiscal framework question. You are 100% correct on the other piece that, you know, life after COVID, if there really is a life after COVID, by that I mean,
right.
You know, I think we'll still be constantly dealing with some element of a virus until at least such time as there's a vaccine. So we have actually we've actually tied that in to our plea at this time of emergency funding, because we've actually already have the numbers and laid out the facts as to it's not only a drop in revenue, but it's an increase in cost of how we operate. So what you've just said is sort of, and in fact, the cost of many of the things that we're needing to do with COVID is a higher escalated cost than it would have been under normal circumstances.
Right. I guess I'm thinking about how government negotiations sort of happen too, and you're going to have some level of negotiation. There's going to be some level of prioritizing, right? So the federal government and the province and, you know, FCM and Canada's various municipalities sit down and like, you know, what are the priorities? Like, if there are three things that, you know, have to be done, and it's going to be these three things that you can all agree on, you know, what do you think the three priorities are in terms of whether that's funding, whether that's new programming, new initiative? You know, what are the three big things you need right now?
Yeah, so the immediate is direct allocated funding to help with our operating losses, the money that is unrecoverable, okay? So that out of the $10 billion in emergency funding, Adam, we're talking about, we're actually earmarking $7.6 billion in direct allocation for all municipalities. In other words, even smallest of the smallest are having financial issues during this. So that would be based on population.
Mm-hmm.
And then out of the $10 billion, we're also earmarking or calling for $2.4 billion for municipalities that have transit systems like Guelph.
Mm-hmm.
I bet you would be able in a heartbeat to get a number of what the transit losses are in Guelph, because nationally, Guelph included, they add up to $400 million a month.
Mm-hmm.
So the 2.4 would be based on ridership. So that brings us back to almost square one in terms of what our revenue losses are. Then what we've said, and we've been very strategic about this, because we started talking collectively with some of the cabinet ministers early on about recovery, and personally, several of us felt that it was too early to talk about that. We needed to talk specifically about the financial losses, but we're equally as excited, quite frankly, for the opportunity to be able to work with the federal government, cabinet ministers like Catherine McKinnon in infrastructure, to be able to work on a program that we can really be leaders in helping the economy grow through some infrastructure funding. And certainly those discussions have been held in an early stage, but we need to continue those as well. So there, you asked for three. Those are the two that jump out at me as number uno, number one, and number two.
Right.
Urgent emergency funding funding for operating losses, and number two, the recovery.
Yeah. You said earlier you were an optimist, and so looking ahead a bit, I realize we can't really guess in specific terms what things will look like, you know, a year hence, 2 years hence. But do you feel optimistic that, you know, the COVID issues have brought to light a lot of the long-term systemic issues that cities like Halifax and Guelph have been battling for years? And do you think that we've learned that lesson, that the one of the positives that come out of this is that there will be a new deal for cities, and maybe that we can move forward on a lot of these initiatives that we've kind of been stuck in neutral on, things like more transit funding, more affordable housing funding, things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. So thank you very much. Absolutely. You know, again, each one of those I could go on, which I'm not going to for you or me, but on the housing, for example, we are again, and give all accolades to this current government that in their last mandate, they did pass a national housing strategy, which we've been calling for successive governments for a decade. We have that now. So we do need the funding now to flow with this, with the strategy. Likewise, on your transit, that is one of the commitments in their last platform of the Liberal Party. Now the government, and they have committed to an incredible amount of funding for electrification of buses, that sort of thing, and we need to hold them to that commitment as well.
Mm-hmm.
So New Deal, it's interesting you say that because I'm going to actually parallel that to the call I was on just before you called.
Mm.
We have just within the last 40 minutes started rolling out first to the board. First, our CEO at FCM, Brock Carlton, has been known now to the board since November that he's retiring.
Mm.
And we just, through 6-month process, named an internal candidate who was our executive director of policy, Carol Saab, was named to the new CEO of FCM.
Mm-hmm.
And that's huge for us because, quite frankly, Carol has been very instrumental in really leading FCM over the last number of years when it comes to the gains we've had with the federal government. So when you say there's the potential of a new deal, all of our bucks are pinned on Carol Saab being able to help us deliver that. So
I appreciate that, and I appreciate us being able to have this chat today. And,
yeah, no, it's been great. You seem really on top of this issue, and I commend you for that, because this is the sustainability of municipalities in Canada rests on us getting this funding.
Well, goodness, I hope there's life after COVID. That was Adam. Once again, remind us. Adam, are you there?
Bill Carsten.
Bill Carsten. I was going to say something different because he said Catherine McKinnon. That threw me a bit there. I guess
that was not Catherine McKinnon.
He meant Catherine McKenna. Catherine McKinnon's a singer, right? Very well-known singer from Nova Scotia who sang the...
I think you mean Catherine McKenna, the current infrastructure minister.
But he said Catherine McKinnon as in Spring Hill mining disaster. A minor point, but great interview.
Well, that might have been his Halifax accent.
It's good to hear that you're so on top of things. That was nice of him to say that, I guess. But so he's outgoing. When is he? He's retiring soon, or he's just not going to run again? So
I think he's just not running again. I think Halifax has its municipal elections this year.
Right. So anyway, we're going to talk a bit about Yahoos, but we are completely out of time. You believe it? So much talking that we can't do it. But we'll save the Yahoos for another day. Just everybody.
Well, maybe just to wrap up Yahoos, I'll point out that they drew circles in Trinity Bellwoods Park today. Those circles apparently cost $12 per circle to make. So,
whoa.
If you're in Toronto, please use them.
Sit in the damn circle, Toronto people. Adam, where can people reach you, find out about you, and get all on top of Guelph Politico?
I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can go to Guelph Politico at guelphpolitico.ca.
And I am Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter, and you can email me if you like, scottyhertz@bell.net. You've been listening to Open Sources Guelph, heard here every Thursday on CFRU 93.3 FM. We'll talk to you next week, and stay tuned for a classic episode of Sounds Good to Me. Take care, folks, and we'll talk to you next week.